Stone Telling, Part 2. From that day, my mother would not answer to her middle name Willow, and told people to call her Towhee, though many were reluctant to do so. To go back to a first name is to go against the earth, and though the Towhee is not altogether a sky dweller, being often on the ground picking up corn with the poultry and seeds with the quail, and not altogether a wild bird, since it walks about the commonplaces of towns, yet it comes from the four houses and returns to them, and its name should come to one who does the same. Cave Woman and Shell talked with my mother about the name, but she would not change her mind. It was set away from the earth. Soon after my father left Tsinshan, we heard that all the Condor men had left the valley, crossing the hills on the north road. On that day, my mother joined the Lamb Lodge. She gave a lot of time to them and learned their arts and mysteries and became their butcher. I kept apart from all that, not only because I was still a child, but because I did not like it, and knew my grandmother did not like it. As it seemed to me, my mother had sent my father away, and I could not forgive her. Since he had spoken to me from the doorway, asking me to wait for him, the passion of my love had gone to him. I thought I did not love my mother at all. I thought continually of how my father would come back to me on his big horse at the head of a line of soldiers and find me waiting for him. My loyalty to him made my difference from other people a virtue and gave unhappiness both a reason and a term. I danced the world that year, my ninth, the first I danced. With Valiant and Ninepoint and all the people of my house of earth, I danced the sky, and in the sky the people of cloud, wind, rain, clarity danced the earth with us. From then on I worked harder with Ninepoint, and also with Patient of the Madrone Lodge, who read the histories and narratives of Tsinshan and the valley with a group of us children. I began to spend more time at the pottery shops with Clay Sun. I worked on the little plot we used, and each year I did more shared work in the fields of Tsinshan. In my 12th year, I was initiated into the Planting Lodge, and also began to learn Blood Lodge songs. My grandmother's hands became so rheumatic that she could not spin or do fine weaving, and my mother did the weaving, but I did not work with her. What I enjoyed most was making pottery, and I began to do it fairly well. Every summer I would go out for 4 days from Gaheya into the coyote's house, and on my third walk like that, going northwest along a creek bed in a gully outside Hunch Mountain and thinking about making pots, I found a bank of very fine blue clay in the dry creek bed. Several times I brought as much of it as I could carry to Clay Sun, who was pleased with it. I offered to show him the place. He said it would be better for me to keep it in my mind and use. He was a kind, warm man, a widower with 3 obsidian children who were always dirty or muddy. He called me Owl Pot instead of North Owl, and he called his children the Pots. He thought of very little besides clay and shaping and glazing and firing. It was a good thing for me to learn a craft with a true maker. It may have been the best thing I have done. Nothing we do is better than the work of hand-mind. When mind uses itself without the hands, it runs the circle and may go too fast. Even speech, using the voice only, may go too fast. The hand that shapes the mind into clay or written word slows thought to the gate of things and lets it be subject to accident and time. Purity is on the edge of evil, they say. 2 years after my father left the valley, my grandfather came up from Chumo to live in his wife's household again. Though she did not like him, she had never put him out. He had left. Now she took him back, partly because she thought he needed her, and partly, I think, because since her hands had become crippled, she was ashamed of doing less work in the house and town, and she thought he might work in her place. In fact, she did a great deal of work, as always, and he did little. He spent his time with the warriors. He had come to Tsinshan to be a speaker in that lodge, and to bring more Tsinshan men into it. The warriors had been doing more and more things the Bay Laurel boys were supposed to do. scouting, watching the outside ridges, making weapons, training people in the use of guns, having trials of strength and endurance, and teaching various kinds of fighting. Before the Warrior Lodge began, the Bay Laurel Society in Sinshan had not been very lively. They planted tobacco and cured it, of course, and they went camping over on She Watches and sang and kept a box full of very old guns, which they oiled and polished but did not shoot. Some of the men in charge of the Bay Laurel said, "Listen, a while ago our boys used to go scouting over on the wrong side of the hills, stirring up the people over in those valleys. Then those people would send their boys over here, and sheep got stolen, and people were afraid to go out alone, and we had to start talking about smoking and having a war. That hasn't happened in Sinshan for 40 or 50 years. A while ago we made guns and trained with them. Then pretty soon the boys got into quarrels with boys from Onmalin and Tachas Tochas, and feuds began, and young men were killed on the roads in the hills. That hasn't happened for a long time. What do you want it to happen for?" The warrior speakers said, "Go in peace. Go about your farming and hunting and herding. We'll patrol the ridges." They said, "We want only a few, the bravest young men." But they took any man who asked to join. My cousin in Madidino, Hops, began to wear the undyed clothing and became a warrior, too. His middle name came from them, Spear. My cousin Pelican, his sister, was my age, and we still were good friends. I told her that I was glad Hops hadn't taken one of those warrior names like my grandfather Corruption, or Corpse, or Maggot, or an old man in Madidino who had taken Dog Shit for his last name. But I thought Spear was pretty silly. He might as well call himself Big Penis and be done with it. She didn't laugh. Nobody ever wanted to laugh at the warriors. She told me that Spear was a powerful name, and all the names I made fun of were powerful names. I didn't care. I kept out of all that and did not want to learn about it. Since our household was full of warrior and lamb lodge talk now, I spent more time outside. I did not go regularly to patients' classes, so I learned very little history and read almost nothing. I worked at the pottery with Clay Sun, and in the sheepfolds and pastures and fields. Twice in those years I went with the great flocks down to the saltgrass pastures at the mouths of the Na, staying there all through the moon. The summer that I was 13 years old, I went up the valley with some other young people, and then alone on Ama Kolkan. I walked beyond the springs of the river, through the 5 houses and through the 4 houses, to the house that has no wall. Yet I walked in ignorance, and it was the kindness of the lion, the mercy of the hawk, that held me on the way. Things were not right in my household, and my people did not see to it that I got a proper education. I know that Valiant worried about my ignorance and carelessness, and that she and Ninepoint talked about it. But I would not listen to their advice, and she was not willing to argue with me. She was worried about her daughter, too, and in pain often, and low-hearted. I think she wanted to send her husband away, but felt that she could not, because he did some of the work she could no longer do, and so she thought my mother and I needed him in the household. I would have danced on the rooftops to see him go, but a child cannot tell her grandmother to put her grandfather's things out on the landing. As for my mother, Tohi, she was always silent and aloof, as if when she refused to speak to my father she had stopped speaking to anyone. I did most of the sheep herding now, and she did lamb lodge work. She and my grandfather got on well enough, since the lamb women were a kind of woman warriors. They performed some wakwa together. Some lamb women took power names. Bones had used to be Brodiea, and Finch took the middle name Putrid. All those who performed the purification wakwa called themselves, while they were dancing, the Mawasto. That word was the Condor word Marastso, army, which I had heard every day when I went with my father to the camp in eucalyptus pastures. Once I said something about it, and Corruption and Towhee both jumped on me with both feet, denying that the word was a Condor word, and telling me that I could have no knowledge about such matters, since I had not been taught by the warriors or the lambs. I was immensely angry that what I knew to be so should be denied. I did not forgive them for that denial. But I was still a child and able to forget 50 things while doing 50 others. Some of my age-mates were adolescent, but I was slow at that, and not sorry to be so. I thought about being a blood clown, but was too lazy to go start instruction at the blood lodge. My closest friend in those years, a blue clay girl called Cricket, had already been initiated into the blood lodge and wore undyed clothing, but her middle name had not come to her, and she and I worked and played together as children. In the fields, or with the sheep, or gathering, we would bring our toys along and play stories with them in between fits of working. Her toys were a human person made of wood, with elegant knee and elbow joints, so that it took lifelike positions, and a mangy old lamb's wool sheep that she used to sleep with as a baby. Mine were a rabbit made of rabbit skin with the fur on, a wooden cow, and a coyote I had made myself out of scraps of buckskin. I had tried to make it look like the coyote on She Watches who had sat and looked at me the first time I went alone on the mountain. It did not look like that coyote, or any coyote, but there was something heia about it. When we played stories and talked for the animals, I never knew what the coyote was going to say. We made long stories with those five people. Their town was called Shikashan. A boy called Lark Rising, from the red adobe, often played with us. His toys were three beautiful redwood animals his mother had carved for him, tree squirrel, ground squirrel, and wood rat. Cricket always made up the best stories to play, but she only wanted to play them once and then make a new one. Lark Rising wrote three of them down and made an offering of them to the library in his heimas called Stories About Shikashan, and we were all proud of that. So those were good times. Often in the evenings I would go, and my cousins would come from Madidino to Blue Rock to meet and talk. But there the warriors got between us again. Spear no longer gave a flower or a pebble to the rock, or brushed it with pollen, or even spoke to it, although Blue Rock is the strongest heia in all the fields of Sinshan and Madidino. Pelican said ruha to it when her brother wasn't listening, or put a pebble down near it, as if she just happened to be putting a pebble down. But when we talked about it, she agreed with Spear and not with me. Spear said that there had never been sacredness in rocks or springs, but in the mind-soul, the spirit, only. The rock and the spring and the body, he said, were screens that kept the spirit from pure sacredness, true power. I said Heia was not like that. It was the rock, it was the water running, it was the person living. If you gave Blue Rock nothing, what could it give you? If you never spoke to it, why should it speak to you? Easy enough to turn from it and say, the sacredness has gone out of it. But it was you that had changed, not the rock. You had broken the relation. When I argued that way, Pelican would start to agree with me. But then she would agree with her brother when he talked. If Blue Rock said anything to her, she was not listening. None of us was. After I was 13, Spear did not come to Blue Rock with his sister. Many boys living on the coast go off with the hunters or the bay laurel and make a sweat house to sleep in and keep away from girls, which I could understand. But the warrior way of living on the coast was to forbid the young men even to speak to adolescent girls. My side-grandfather, Nine Point, talked about that once to his grandson, who had taken the name Vile when I was there to hear. He said, "You call yourself vile, but you act like puffed up. Are you so afraid of girls you have to make war on them? Are you so afraid of yourself you have to fight with yourself? Who do you think you are to be so afraid of, anyhow?" If I had been less willful and fearful, I could have learned much I needed to learn from Nine Point. But he was a stern person, and I was unwilling to let him scold me for my laziness and ignorance. I look back now and see that I was afraid to love him, as if to love him were to be disloyal to my father, kills. But I heard what he said to Vial that time with pleasure, for I was humiliated by Spear's avoidance of me, and hated the warriors with all my heart. My grandfather spoke with contempt to his wife and mother and granddaughter and all women, and therefore I felt great contempt for him. But out of respect for the household, I tried not to show it. My grandmother did when she lost her temper. Once she said to him, "You're trying to be like those Condor men who are so afraid of women they run 1,000 miles away from their own women so as to rape women they don't know." But that blow missed Corruption, who was too hard to feel it, and hit my mother, Towhee, instead. She was in the hearth room with me and heard what Valiant had said. She hunched up, swallowing pain. Then I turned on my grandmother in anger, because I was holding the Condor in my heart now as the name of the freedom and strength my father had given me for that half-year he had been with us. I went to the doorway between the rooms and said, "That's not true. I am a Condor woman." They all stared at me. Now the blow had hit them all, but most of all my grandmother. She looked at me with desolate eyes. I went out of the house, out of the town. I went up Sinshan Creek, to the springs of the water, and sat there for a long time, angry at myself and everybody in my household, everybody in Sinshan, everybody in the valley. I put my hands in the water, but there was no washing away the stuff that choked up my heart and mind. I could not even say heya when the guardian of the spring came as a junco, lighting on the wild azalea bush above the spring. I longed to go walk on the mountain again, but knew that if I did, it would be no good. I would not put my feet in the tracks of the lion, on the way of the coyote, but would walk the circle of human anger. So I did, round and round, all that year long. It brought me back to the spring, in the days before the water, with a blue clay jar from the hayamas to be filled for the evening singing. As I came back down the path where it crosses Little Buckeye Creek and comes up among the live oaks onto Big Knoll, I saw my cousin Spear sitting on the bank above the creek bed, one leg crossed over the other, trying to get something out of the sole of his foot. He said, "North Owl, can you see this damned thorn?" That was the first time he had spoken to me for 2 years. I stood down in the dry creek bed and searched the sole of his heel till I saw the butt of the thorn and worked it out with my nails. "What are you doing here on our creek?" I said then. "Coming back from patrolling," he said. "The others went on ahead. I had to get this thorn out. Thanks." He still sat there, squeezing his foot where it was sore. "Why do you go barefoot?" I asked. "Oh, we're supposed to," he said unimportantly. He was talking the way he used to when he was hops, and he looked at me with kind eyes. "Are you dancing the water?" he asked. It was 9 days before the water that day. I said yes, and he said, "I'll come here. Sinshan dances the water better than Madidino. Anyhow, all my blue clay relatives are here." I said nothing. I was distrustful of him. He looked very beautiful in the undyed clothing. The only warrior thing he wore was a cap of black goat's wool. It was peaked like the Condor helmets, but he had squashed it and pushed it back on his head. The air over Sinshan Mountain had turned watermelon pink, and the wild oats on Big Knoll held a reflection of that color, a faint, clear rose. The tarweed was in bloom, smelling strong. I picked a leaf of wild mint from the creek bed and put it on the drop of blood on the hard, dark skin of his heel where the thorn had come out. "I have to take this to the hayamas and then go on to the obsidian," I said finally. I wanted him to know that I was going to the blood lodge for instruction now, and I wanted to go because I felt so bewildered at his talking to me in the old way, but I also did not want to go. This time he did not answer for a little while. When he did, he spoke tenderly and thoughtfully. "When will you put on those clothes?" he said, and I told him it would be after the water at the next full moon. He said, "I'll come. I'll come to High Porch House for the party." He smiled, and for the first time I thought that there would be a party for my entrance into the Blood Lodge, a party at which I would wear the new clothes belonging to my new way of being. I said, "We'll have plenty of mushroom pastries then." Once, when we were all children at a sun festival in Medidino, he had eaten a whole tray of mushroom pastries before anybody else got any, and he had been teased about it for years after. "Good," he said. "I'll eat them." "Oh, North Owl, who will you be then?" I said, "The same I am now, mostly." He said, "Who are you now?" He looked at me until I looked away. He said again, "Oh, North Owl, sometimes..." Then he said nothing more. I thought then, I think now, that the person who looked straight at me had come from inside him that day, and he had forgotten about being the warrior who turned away, and the man, and the self. He had sat by the dry creek bed, and the soul of the water had come into him. I stopped being afraid of him, and began talking to him, I do not know about what, and he answered, and so we talked for some while, trustfully and quietly. When the madrone grove at the top of Big Knoll looked black against the sky, and the color was gone out of the air, we went along the path above Sinshan Creek, I first, he following, side by side where the path widened. When we came up onto the dancing place, the evening star was bright, and the well star shone above the black eucalyptus. We crossed the hinge together, and he said, "I'll come to the dancing," and went on towards the bridge. I went into High Porch House with a different heart in me than when I left it. Spear came to all four nights of the water in Sinshan, and also he came, as he had promised, to High Porch House for my blood singing. It was a small party, since I had only half a family, and that a small one, and not all of them very generous or sociable. But Nine Points sang the father's song for me, and gave me a bowl of porcelain, glazed blood-red with mercury from Sinshan Mountain, and my grandmother gave me her necklace of turquoise from the Omorn Sea. I wore the undyed clothes my mother had made for me from cotton I had picked and spun the year before, a triple skirt and full-sleeved shirt, and with them an overvest of very delicate plain linen, Shell's gift to me. I had made a great many mushroom pastries, so many we gave away baskets of them after the dancing. Spear led the line dance with me. He was a lithe and graceful dancer. He looked at me across the line, smiling. In my heart I gave him a name I thought better suited to him than the name Spear. I called him Puma Gaze. So I came into the house of womanhood with that young lion dancing in my mind. That was a piece of good luck in a bad luck time, though I would not have said so when Spear turned away from me again the next year. I thought there was no good in the world at all then. I blamed the warrior lodge for taking him away from me, and indeed they did, but his house or his household might well have done the same. We were meeting and talking here and there, not often, but oftener than by chance. I was 15 years old, and he 17, half-cousins. It was not the time for us to come inland, nor was it as distant a kinship as could be desired if marriage came into the matter. His sister was jealous of me, and no longer friendly, and some people of his house in Medidino and in Sinshan did not approve of me, a half-houseless woman, as head of their kinsman's household, if we married. All that I knew, and did not care about at all. I do not think I cared for or thought about anything that year except Spear, but I do not know how to write about it. To try to remember that kind of feeling is to try to remember being very drunk, or to try to go mad sanely. To talk about being in love, you have to be in love, and I have not been in love again. At the moon dance, I think all the young warriors took some kind of vow of abstinence, and after that time Spear did not meet me, nor look at me when we passed, nor answer when I spoke to him the few times I saw him. In despair, I followed him into Medidino fields in an afternoon in the end of the dry season. I said, "You don't come to Sinshan any more." He turned away and went on working. He was gleaning the last of the gunice grapes of that great vineyard. The latest grapes make the finest wine, they say. I said, "Are brave men afraid to talk to women?" He said nothing. I said, "Once I gave you a name in my heart. Do you want to know what it was? He said nothing, did not look at me, and went on working. I left him there with his cutting knife and basket, and walked away between the long-armed, contorted vines. Their large leaves were rust-colored in the dusty light. The wind blew dry and hard. Because Spear was a warrior, and I wanted his life and mine to be as close and alike as they could be, I had gone to Lamb Lodge meetings and taken instruction from them all that year. The love in me loved everything he loved. My thoughts and feelings were all swallowed up in that. I was the servant of my love, and served it as my father's soldiers served him, unquestioning. And I found that that was how it was in the Lamb Lodge. They spoke of love, of service, of obedience, of sacrifice. Such ideas filled up my mind all that year, and my heart was high and hot with them. Nothing that I did or handled or made or knew as I lived the days was of any importance to me compared to those ideas. Loving, serving, obeying, sacrificing. The Lamb Lodge women told me that we could not know the warrior rites because the only suitable way for a woman to understand such mysteries was by loving, serving, and obeying the men who understood them. I accepted this because it was Spear all along who was the idea in my mind and body, and I had no other. The others were reflections of him, him and nothing else. That whole year I lived in the Lamb Lodge was a lie, a denial of my own knowledge and being, and yet a truth at the same time. Almost everything is double like that for adolescents. Their lies are true, and their truths are lies, and their hearts are broken by the world. They gyre and fall, they see through everything, and are blind. The Lambs and Warriors were houses for adolescents, people who were not able to choose their own way yet, or unwilling ever to do so. Because I was Corruption's granddaughter and Tohi's daughter, I had been advanced quickly in the Lamb Lodge. A few days after I spoke to my half-cousin in the vineyard, I was to officiate in one of the seventh-day rites of the lodge. It was a sacrifice. I feel that I should not write down what was done, even though there is no Lamb Lodge now, and what I wrote would be a mere curiosity. My hand is not easy. It will not write down what my voice promised to keep secret, the mystery. It was no mystery, but the promise was a promise. Everybody knew, however, because they had to see it, that the officiant of that mystery did not wash after sacrificing the bird or animal, but came out of the lodge house with bloody hands as a visible sign of the sacred act. So I came back to High Porch House. My grandmother, Valiant, was setting out dinner in the hearth room on a tablecloth she had woven years ago, white linen with a blue thread every fourth warp and fifth warp alternately. It was worn, fine, and very clean. I was looking at that cloth as she spoke to me. She said, "Go wash your hands, North Owl." She knew I was supposed to leave the blood on my hands until the next day. She hated that rule and all such lamb and warrior rules. She was disgusted. Her heart was sore that I followed such practices. I knew that. I, too, was disgusted and heart-sore and full of hatred. I said, "I can't." She said, "Then you can't eat at this table." Her voice and lips and hands trembled. I could not endure her pain. I said, "I hate you," and ran down the stairs and across the commonplace to the bridge. Why I went that way, towards the valley, not towards the hills, I don't know. I went across the bridge and saw a tall dun horse standing with the calves and donkeys in the creek paddock. I stopped, looking at that horse. My father came up the path from the barns. He saw me with tears on my face, with blood on my hands and arms. I saw he did not know me. I said, "I am your daughter." He came forward then and took my hands in his hands. I began to cry aloud. Some people came by from the fields, coming home, and one of them spoke in greeting to my father, saying, "So you have come home, man of High Porch House. This is a good day you have made." I controlled my weeping. and my father and I went up onto the terraces of Topknot Hill and sat there on the stone-facing wall of the top terrace of vines, overlooking the lower houses of Sinshan and all Sinshan fields in the afternoon light. It had been a hot, dry summer. Forest fires were burning over behind the northeast range, and the air was dull and blurred with smoke, so that the hills of the northeast range were like blue lines in the blue air. My father had thought that I was injured when he saw me blood-stained, and he tried to ask what was wrong. I could not tell him that everything was wrong. I said I had quarreled with my grandmother. He had lost the ready use of our language and had to think before he spoke. I watched him. He had gone bald in front so that his face was longer, and he looked very tired. He was still bigger and taller than I had remembered him, though I had grown from a child's to a woman's height in the years he had been gone. "I came to talk to Willow," he said. I shook my head. My tears came back, and seeing them, he thought that she was dead and made a little sound of pain. I said, "She still lives in the blue clay house, but she isn't Willow. She went back to her name, Tohi." He said, "She has married." "No," I said, "she won't marry. She won't talk to you." He said, "I could not come. You know that." It was not on the Amaranth coast, but in the north, that we had to take the army. He said where he had been, names of places that I did not know, and said again, "I could not come when I said I would come. I want to tell her that." I shook my head again. All I could say was, "She will not talk to you." He said, "Why should she talk to me? To come again here was stupid." I could feel the going in him, and I cried out, "I talk to you. I waited, I waited, I waited for you to come." He looked at me then instead of at his thoughts and said my name, North Owl. I said, "I am not that person. I am not a child. I am not anybody. I have no name. I am the Condor's daughter." "You are my daughter," he said. I said, "I want to go with you." He did not understand what I meant at first and then said, "No, how can I do that? They would keep you. I must go this day or the next day. They will not let you go away." I said, "I am a woman and make my own choices. I will go with you." He said, "You must ask people." "I'll tell them," I said. "You are the only one I must ask. Will you take me with you?" More than anything, I wanted him not to go down to High Porch House to my mother. It was as if I was trading myself for her. I did not understand this then, but I felt it. My father thought for a while, gazing across the valley to Soul Mountain with its flat, slanting top. The smoke haze was a pale, dull pink color. He said, "I should ask her to let you go with me. Is it true she will not speak to me?" "It is true," I said truthfully. "And it is true you have waited for me," he said, looking again at me. I said, "Give me a name." When he understood, he thought for a long time, and at last said, "Do you want this name, Ayatyu?" I said, "My name is Ayatyu." I did not ask the meaning of the name then. To me it was my father's kindness, my own freedom. Later, when I spoke his language, I knew Ayatyu in the valley language would be well-born woman or woman born above others. It is a name that was often given in my father's family. His name was Terter Abhau, and taking his father's name as daughters and sons of a man do among that people, I was Terter Ayatyu. "When will you go?" I asked him. He asked, "Can you ride?" "I ride donkeys," I said. "I used to ride your horse with you." He looked again at the roofs of the houses of Sinshan and said, "Yes, in the wars I thought of that. Many, many times. The little girl sitting with me in the saddle. Those days in this place, this valley. Those were my good days. Not ever again." I waited, and he said, I will bring a horse for you when the sun rises the day after tomorrow, at that place. He pointed to the bridge where we had met. I will not come into this town, he said. His sorrow and desire were becoming anger and turning away. He had come a long way, with difficulty, to see his wife, yet he did not go to see her. I have thought about that time we sat on the terrace on Top Knot Hill many times, and tried to understand why we spoke and behaved as we did. We were both ill, and our illnesses spoke one to the other. We seemed to choose, but were driven. I clung to him, yet I was the stronger. He said, Tell them that you wish to go with me. If they let you do this, take leave of them rightly, and go to your Heimas. This will be a long journey, a long time you will be gone, daughter. He was right to speak so, and I did as he said. On the second morning, at the earliest return of light, my grandmother Valiant went to our Heimas with me. We filled the water basin and sang the return. She marked the Heia if on my cheeks with blue clay from Sinshan Creek. She and I came up from the Heimas in the dawn. My mother was waiting for me at the hinge of town, and Lark Rising and Cricket also, and they all came to the bridge with me. But we did not squat and piss and laugh before we said farewell, because the condor was waiting there on his tall horse. They stopped at the southeast end of the bridge. I embraced them and ran across the bridge to him. He looked at Tohi, but she had turned away. He helped me mount the horse he had brought, and so I rode away with him through Sinshan Fields. The lodge rejoining, where we learn how to die, was built that year on the planting side where Hechu Creek meets Sinshan Creek. We rode past it as the range across the valley let the sun go. Singing Heya to the sun, I rode. We went past the vineyards to the old straight road, and northwest on the road towards Amakulkan. The horses strode along fast. My father had brought a sorrel mare for me to ride, shorter and more delicate than his gelding. He kept beside me watchfully, telling me how to hold with my knees and how to use the stirrups and reins. It was much easier than riding donkeys bareback. Donkeys have sharp backbones and minds of their own, while the mare was obliging and kindly, and the saddle comfortable. We rode to Telinana, and passed between Chukomas and Chumo, and past Kastohana, and still it was bright morning. As we turned to the mountain road, the geyser leaped up out of the feathered grasses, shining. My heart turned in me when I saw that. I thought of the old man who had given me a song there. I put the thought and the song away from me. We crossed the river on the oak bridge, and I said Heya silently. In the foothills of the mountain, five men of the condor, mounted and with two pack horses, came to meet us, saluting my father. We stopped at the Tembedin Oaks to eat some food, and then rode on up into the mountain on the Clear Lake Road. Where the way to Wakwaha and the springs of the river went to the left, we went to the right, following the line of the train as far as Metoli, where we took the shortcut road. Before night, we stopped to make camp in Live Oak Woods on the wrong side of Metoli Spring. I could not get off the horse, and my father, laughing, had to help me. My legs and buttocks were as stiff as wood, and pretty soon they began to ache. The condor men joked a little, but cautiously. They treated me partly as a child, but also with something like fear, and they knocked their forehead with their fist when they first spoke to me, as they did to my father. We two sat a little apart and did nothing while they made the fire, cooked the dinner, and laid out the beds. After eating, I went to talk to the sorrel mare for a while. I smelled of her now, and liked the smell. I had never made a friend so easily. My father talked for a long time to one man who was to ride a different way the next day, giving him several messages, some quite long, to carry in his head. He made him repeat them, and they were still doing this when I came back to the fire. It was boring to listen to, as I did not know the language. When they were done and the man had gone back to the other men, I said, Why didn't you write the messages? He can't read, my father said. If he was blind or weak-minded, he made a strange messenger, I thought, but I could not see what was wrong with him. I said so. "Writing is sacred," my father said. I knew that already. "Show me your writing," I said. He said, "Writing is sacred, not for Hontik. You don't need to write words." I did not understand, was all that I understood of this, so I said, "I need words to speak, anyhow. What is Hontik?" And he began then to teach me his language, how the Dayao said to ride a horse, to see a rock, and all the rest. It was cold up there on the side of the mountain in the night. The other men sat on the other side of the fire, talking. My father joined in the talk from time to time, briefly, with dignity in the tone of his voice. He gave me some hot brandy, and I soon slept, curled up in grandmother's arm. In the morning he had to lift me onto the horse, but as soon as we had ridden a little way, the stiffness went out of my legs, and I was easy in the saddle. So we rode up to the pass in the fog of the autumn morning, in the way of the white puma. I have heard people in the Finder's Lodge say that when they leave the valley, even though they have left and returned many times, there is a pain in their heart, or a voice singing in their ears, or a whitening, or a sense of falling, always some sign. Downstream, the historian of the Tsinshan Finders said that he knew when he entered the valley because for 9 breaths his feet did not touch the ground, and when he left the valley he knew it because for 9 breaths he walked knee-deep through earth. Maybe because I was on horseback, or because I was with the condor, or because I was half a condor, I felt no sign. Only when I touched my cheeks and felt no mark of the blue clay from Tsinshan Creek left there, again my heart turned and went dark and small inside its house. It stayed that way as we rode down the wrong side of the mountain. All that country between the mountain and Clear Lake is very beautiful and like the valley. Rocks, plants, all the people are the same kinds, and the human people live in towns and farms like the towns and farms of the valley. We did not stay with any of them, nor did we speak to people anywhere. When I asked why, my father said that these were people of no account. We rode as if in another house, without speech. I thought, this is why they are called condors. They go in silence, above all the others. When we were in the Golden Hills, northeast of Clear Lake, lying down to sleep on the third night, I began to feel the valley behind me like a body, my own body. My feet were the sea channels of the river, the organs and passages of my body were the places and streams, and my bones the rocks, and my head was the mountain. That was all my body, and I, here, lying down, was a breath soul going farther away from its body every day. A long, very thin string connected that body and that soul, a string of pain. I slept, and the next day went on riding, and talked with my father, learning his language. Often we laughed. Still, I felt that I was not quite my body, and that I weighed nothing, like a soul. Indeed, I grew thin on that long journey. The condor food did not taste good to me. They carried dried meat, all beef. Along the way, they sometimes killed cattle or sheep grazing on those high hills. They did not ask me to, but I came and gave the person they killed my words. At first I thought the human people of these families were generously giving us the animals' deaths, and wondered why I never saw the human people, and why they never gave vegetables or grain or fruit, since it was harvest time. Then I saw two of the men of our group kill a strayed ewe by the path without giving her any word, cutting off her legs for food and leaving the head and hooves and entrails and fleece for the maggots and coyotes. For several days I put what I had seen away from my mind, but I did not eat that mutton. Many, many times while I lived with the condor people, I put a thing I saw away, saying, "I'll think about that later," or refusing to think about it at all. This was not mindfulness, but where everything was outside me, I could not make all of it enter into me, and when it did enter into me, I often felt as if I had no soul at all. And it is the attentive soul that tells the mind, remember. Now I am trying to write down my journey to the Northeast, to bring it all into my mind at last, but a great deal of it, and of all my years with the Dayao, is lost and will not come back. I could not take it in. I remember with great clarity how we rode all in line across the last pass of the wrinkled hills, and from it saw the wide valley of the River of the Marshes all before us to the north and east. Far in the southeast was the shore of the inland sea, hazy and shining. A broad golden light lay over the yellow willows by the river and the cattail marshes and the far peaks of the range of light, slanting from under clouds behind us. I sang Heya to that great river, and the beauty and vastness of the world, and to the sun going into the house of winter. That night it rained, all the next day and the next, as we followed the River of the Marshes north, we rode and walked in rain. We crossed that big river at a ford where it spread out in many shallow channels, and the horses did not have to swim far, so early in the rainy season. At that ford another group of Condor men joined us, 12 of them. So we were a big group going along, 19 human people and 25 horses, one mare with a colt following. As they rode, the men liked to sing a song they had. Where the city is, I am coming. Where the Condor is, I am coming. Where the battle is, I am coming. They put any word they liked into the song and sang, Where the food is, I am coming, or Where the cunt is, I am coming, over and over as they rode along in line. After long rain, there was a day I remember when the sky partly cleared and we saw Culcan Huen pouring a stream of dun smoke up into the clouds southeast of where we were. All around the dark volcano was a roil of steam and smoke from lesser vents, and the air stank like rotten eggs when the wind changed. We began to come near the foothills of the volcanoes. I was very much afraid of them, and dreamed all night that fiery cracks were gaping in the earth about me, and clouds of smoke were burning and choking me, but I said nothing about my cowardice. On the next day the whole sky cleared, and from those hills looking north I saw the mountain of the north hanging snow-streaked from the sky down to the dark forests. One pure plume of steam rose from its eastern crown, like a down feather of the white egret. Because the mountain was beautiful, and because I knew its name from maps and stories in the Heimas, the sight of it made me happy. I recognized it. I sat on the mare singing Heya to it. My father rode up beside me and said, That is Tsatasyan, the White Mountain. I said, Also it is Culcan Arayan, one of the places where the arms of the world meet. He said, I spent 10 years of my life winning the land around that mountain for the Condor, and now it's all to do over. He used the word Zariert, which I had learned playing long dice with the soldiers. It means to win at gambling, like our word, dumi. I could not imagine what he meant, how he had won an enormous piece of the world like that, or who he had won it from, or what use it was to him. I tried to ask, and he tried to explain, but we talked backwards for a while, and he grew impatient with my stupidity. This here is land the Condor armies won, he said. Why do you think the Hontik aren't shooting at us any more? That was only one place that they shot at us, I said. It had been where we first turned to follow the dark river. Some people hidden in the willow thickets had shot arrows at us, and then ran away when the men tried to chase them. My father had ordered the men to come back and ride on, and they had galloped back laughing and shouting jokes, very excited, so that I was also excited and not afraid, though I certainly had never expected to be part of a war. My father said, That's because they are afraid of us. I gave up trying to understand what he was talking about, but part of my stupidity was that I did not want to understand. Educated people who read this will have been laughing at me, that I could ride for days and days with armed men called soldiers or warriors, with my father the chief of them, and see them steal, and never enter a town or farmstead, and be ambushed, and still not understand that they were at war with every people of the lands we had come through. They are quite right to laugh. I was uneducated, and unwilling to use my mind. Now in these foothills of the volcanoes we came to villages where the people came out and knocked their heads to us instead of keeping out of sight or running their sheep away and turning back to spit after us. The villages were very small, 5 or 6 log houses along a creek, and some sheep or pigs and turkeys, and a lot of dogs barking and snarling. But they were very generous, I thought, giving us food even when there were more of us than of them. After 2 days riding in that broken country, we came to the place called South City, Sainyan. The Dayao word Sai means the same as our word Kach. We use it only to speak of a different place in time or mind, those people who lived outside the world, and the network of the exchanges. They have those uses too, but chiefly they use the word to name the place where they live, saying that they are inhabitants of the city of man. What to us is disaster, to them is their glory. How am I to write all this story in reversal words? People of the Madrone Lodge asked me to write my life story as an offering because nobody else in the valley has lived with the Condor and come back, and so my story is a history. But I wish now I had learned to write history instead of learning to make pots when I was North Owl. When I was Ayatyu, I had to forget writing and reading altogether. The Dayao will blind the eye or cut off the hand of a woman or a farmer who writes a single word. Only the true Condors may write or read, and of them I think only the ones called the One Warriors, who officiate at the Wakwa, learn how to write and read freely. They say that since One made the cosmos by speaking a word, the universe is his book, and to write or read words is to share the power that belongs to One, and only certain men are supposed to share that power. They have the abacus for household use, and in both their cities they had electrical devices made by instructions from the exchange to keep records, but all their records are reduced to numbers. Nothing is written down or printed, and so the word of One remains, as they say, clean. Once in my ignorance I said to my father, "If I wrote Boo on a wall here, all those fierce warriors would scream and run away." He said in anger, "They would punish you, to teach you to fear One." That word is the end of talking, as well as the end of writing, under the Condor's wing, and I said no more. When I went with Abhau, my heart wanted to be a Condor's heart. I tried to be a Condor woman. I tried not to think in the language or the ways of the valley. I wanted to leave the valley, not to be of it, to be new, living a new way. But I could not do that. Only an educated person might do that. I was too young, and had not considered existence, or read books, or trained with the finders, or thought about history. My mind was not freed. It was held inside the valley, instead of holding the valley inside it. Even for my age I was ignorant, because Sinshan, like other small towns, was given to prejudice and willful ignorance, and because my family was a troubled one, and most of all because the warrior and lamb cults had interfered with education and ceremony during my adolescence. So I was not free to go from the valley. Not being entirely a person, I could not become a different person. Also, however willfully I tried, it was difficult for me to become entirely a Condor person. I became as sick as I could, but I was not willing to die. It is almost as hard to write about being Ayatyu as it was to be her. While I am talking about talking, I may explain certain words I have used, or will use. We call them the Condor people. Their name for themselves, as distinct from all other people, is Dayao, One People. I shall call them that in this story now, because the way they use the word Condor Rehemar is complicated. Only one man whom they believe to be a messenger from one to them, and whom they all serve, is called the Condor. Certain men belonging to certain families are called true Condors, and others like them are called, as I said, one warriors. No other people are called Condors. Men who are not of those families are all called Tion, farmers, and must serve the true Condors. Women of those families are called Condor women, and must serve Condor men, but may give orders to Tion and Hontik. The Hontik are all other women, foreigners, and animals. The Condor bird itself is not called Rehemar, but Da Hontik, and is sacred. Boys of the true Condor families must shoot a Condor, or at least a buzzard, to become men. I had the Condor feather that had come to me as a child with me in my pouch of valuables. It was lucky that I did not show it to anyone before I learned that women are not permitted to touch Condor feathers or even to see the Condor in the sky. They are supposed to hide their eyes and wail when the Great One flies. It is easy to say that such customs are barbaric, but then what has one said? Having lived in civilization, in the city of man, I do not use those words, civilized, barbaric. I do not know what they mean. All I can write is what I saw, what I learned, what I did, and let wiser people find a name for it all. The Dayao had built South City about 40 years before I came there. They had come down from the city and made a war with some people who lived in small towns and farmsteads in these foothills south of Dark River, and took their place to live from them. It is not true that they ate the bodies of human people whom they killed in wars. That is a superstition grown out of a symbol. They killed and burned men and children, and kept women to be fucked by Dayao men. They penned the women with the cattle. Some of the women stayed of their own will after a while because their life was destroyed and there was no other place to go, and these women became Dayao. I talked to some of them who told me who they had been before they were made Dayao, but most of them did not like to talk about it. The time when the Dayao made South City was the time when they began making war with everyone. They said, "The Condor rules from the Omorn Sea to the Western Sea, from the North Mountain to the coast of Amaranth." They killed many people and caused pain and long disorder in the volcano country, and infected other people with their sickness. But when I came there, they were dying. It was themselves they ate. I know that now. I did not then. I saw the towers of South City and the walls of black basalt, the wide streets at right angles, the splendor and array. I saw the magnificent bridge across the Dark River and the road that lay straight as a sun track on water to the north, to the city. I saw the machines and engines of work and war they used, of most exact and elegant make, marvelous products of hand mind. All I saw was great and straight and hard and strong, and I saw it all in fear and admiration. My father had had relatives in South City, and we rode to that house, but it was empty. The Dayao make three kinds of house. The farmhouses are much like our farmhouses. The Tion and Hontik in the cities live in huge, long houses, many families to each, like barns or stables. And the true Condor live in family houses, which are dug down into the earth, with low stone walls above ground, no windows, and a peaked timber roof. They look a little like Hayamas, but inside they are entirely different. The house is divided into as many apartments as the people want by movable panels of wood and cloth, 5 or 6 feet high, which can be set against the poles and columns that support the roof. The floor is covered with layers of rugs, and the walls with hangings of cloth, and often the hangings are brought together into a peak at the top of the room, like a tent. The Dayao house remembers the winter dugouts and summer tents of the nomads of the plains of grass, as the wooden houses of Tachas Tochas remember the river forests of the northern coast. All the heating and lighting is electric, from mills and solar cells, and when such a house is furnished and tapestried and brightly lit, it is very warm and comfortable, encompassing. But the house of my father's people in South City that we came to that night was dark and dank, smelling of earth and urine. My father stood inside the entranceway and spoke like a child. "They have gone away!" We had to go to another condor house for shelter and food that night. My father left me with the women of the household and went off to talk with the men. The women smiled at me and tried to talk, but they were timid, and I was very tired and confused. I could not understand why they acted as if they were afraid of me. Among them I felt a little as I had felt in Hardcinder House in Tallina when I was a child, awed by everything. There was metal everywhere. It seemed that copper wire was as common to them as string to us. And they were very good cooks, and though the food was strange to me, I enjoyed most of it very much, after the salt beef and stolen mutton of the soldiers. But their wealth did not flow. They did not give with pleasure. Some of them knocked their heads every time they spoke to me, and others of them did not speak to me at all. Later on I found that the ones who did not speak to me were the Condor women, and the ones who smiled and knocked their heads were the Hontik. I do not remember much of the days we spent in South City. My father was worried and angry, and I saw him only to greet him once each day. I stayed with the women all the time. I did not know then that Dayao women always stayed together and did not go out. Hearing some talk about war, and having seen the city full of armed soldiers, I thought that there must be a war going on at the walls, and that these women were staying inside their house so that the opponents would not steal them, as the Dayao stole women. I had this all figured out, and then found out that there was no fighting at all going on anywhere near South City. I felt foolish, but in fact I had been right. Dayao women lived under siege all their lives. All I thought then was that they were all crazy. I stayed with them all the time in the close, warm rooms, lighted brightly by electricity, trying to learn to talk as they did, and sewing. I was no good at their kind of sewing, and nearly went crazy myself trying to do it hour after hour, when I wanted to be outside in the air, in the light, with my father, or by myself. I was never by myself. At last we left that house and that city and started north. I had missed the sorrel mare very much while I was trapped indoors, and had dreamed every day of riding her again and smelling her smell on my hands and clothes. When the women told me to get into a covered cart with them, I refused. One of the older Condor women ordered me to get into the cart. I said, "Am I dead? Am I a chicken?" But it seemed that among them, live and healthy people rode in carts on wheels, and she did not know what I meant. She got angry, and I got angry. My father came, and I began to tell him that I wanted to ride the sorrel mare. He said, "Get in the cart," and rode on by. He had looked at me as a woman among the other women, a squawking hen among the poultry. He had changed his soul for his power. I stood a while, taking this into myself as best I could, while the other chickens peeped and squawked around me, and then I got up into the cart. All that day, traveling in that cart, I thought, more than I had ever thought before, about how to be a human being. We did not go straight north, but turned off on another wide, smooth road towards the northwest. The women with me said we were going to meet the Marastso, the army, and travel with them, and after a day we did so. All the soldiers who had been traveling in troops to take food from small town people, collecting tribute, they called it, or staying in camps in the dark river and volcano countries giving orders, or, as they called it, keeping order, were gathering together at a place called Rembanyan, and we too went there. We were all following after several chiefs or generals, one of whom was my father. The pieces of the army came with a lot of animals, and a lot of Tion came with the animals and the other Hontik. Those camps were where I first met stolen women, ones the Dayao men had taken from their people and raped when they liked. Some, as I said, were coming freely with the soldiers, and the soldier might stay with the woman and their babies. And so I said something in our camp about these Hontic wives. The women of the Tsayabela household, with whom I traveled, laughed at that and explained that Condor men did not marry Hontic, but only Condor women, the daughters of other Condor men. They were all such daughters themselves, and very positive about what they told me. Stupidly, I said, "But my father, the Condor Terterabhau, is married to my mother in the valley." "It is not a marriage here," one of them said kindly. But when I argued, the old woman, Tsayamayabele, said, "There is no marriage between man and animal, girl. Be still and know your place. We have treated you as a Condor's daughter, not a savage. Behave as such." It was a threat. I heeded it. Aside from learning some things such as that, which I had no desire to know, I enjoyed that slow journey to Rembanyan with the Dayao. I did not have to stay in the cart, but could walk beside it if I stayed near it. At night they set up big tents, a whole town of tents appearing in no time at all. Inside the tents it was bright and warm, the women sitting about on thick red rugs, cooking and talking and laughing and drinking strong manzanita berry tea or honey brandy. Outside, the men called out to one another in the cold dusk. The horses neighed at their pickets and the cattle lowed off where the farmers' campfires glimmered. When it was dark, the people at those fires sang long, lonesome, desolate songs that seemed to have the desert in them. Maybe the Dayao should have been always on the move. Maybe their health as a people was in being nomads, movers on, as they had been in the country north of the Omorn Sea, and before that on the plains of grass. 100 years or more ago they obeyed one of their Condors who had a vision and said that one had commanded them to build a city and dwell in it. When they did that, they locked their energy into the wheel, and so began to lose their souls. After Rembanyan, the whole great train of animals and humans and carts set off through the high, desolate lands northeast of Culcan Arayan. Volcanoes smoked before and behind us. It grew cold, and a wind in our faces brought dark clouds across the sky. In falling snow, we came across a waste of black, broken lava to the city of the Condor. I had not walked in snow before that day. Sai was walled with a guarded gate of great size and beauty. Outside the walls were innumerable barns, stables, shops, and barrack houses, and inside them the streets were straight and wide like those of South City, but still wider and longer. The street that led in from the gate ended in a huge building, window above window above window, and the barrack houses and family houses were all higher and solider and finer than those of South City. Terter House in Sai had its own wall around its gardens of polished black stone. Its roof was of carved cedar, with decks and walkways on it, and down inside it the rooms seemed endless. Apartments and divisions and screened-off corners and nooks and angles, all without windows yet bright, and warm as the silky nest of the wood-rat inside her many-tunneled tall house. The rooms deepest inside were the women's quarters. My father took me there at once. When he turned to go, I held his arm. I said, "I do not wish to stay here, please." He said, without anger, "You live here, Ayatyu. This is your house." I said, "You are my father, but this is not my house." He said, "It is my father's, therefore mine, therefore yours. When you have rested, I'll bring you before him. You should look your best, then, not crying and tired. Go bathe and rest and dress and meet the other girls here. They'll look after you. I'll be back for you in the morning." He went off among the people who knocked their foreheads as he passed. I stood in tears among the women. In that house the two kinds of women, Condor's daughters and Hontic, were as different as sheep and goats. None of the Condor's daughters spoke to me that first night. They left me with the Hontic. I was glad of that, since the Hontic seemed more like valley women, but they were even more afraid of me than the South City women had been. I heard them speak about me, but when I spoke to them in their language, they stared and did not answer, till I felt like a talking crow. They would not leave me alone, but they would not come close to me. At last a girl came in who looked to be my age or a little younger, and who was quick and courageous. She spoke to me and understood what I answered. She said her name was Esiriu. She took me to have a bath, for I was filthy from traveling, and she found a small room for me to sleep in and stayed with me there. She talked faster than I could understand, often, but I understood that she wanted me to be her friend, and she would be a friend to me. She was as prompt and easy about that as the sorrel mare had been. After she had combed out my hair, I said, "Now I'll comb yours." She laughed and said, "No, no, no, Condor's daughter." Without Esiriu, I would not have been able to live in Terter House. I did what she said to do and did not do what she said not to do all the time I was there. She was my slave, whom I obeyed. In the late morning my father came back, dressed in splendid clothing of red and black patterned wool. I went to him, and he embraced me, but he shouted past my ear, "Why has Terter Ayatu Belela not been given suitable clothes to wear?" Then there was a lot of scurrying and forehead-knocking by Hontic and daughters alike, and I was very quickly dressed up in the kind of fine skirt and bodice the daughters wore, with a gauzy headscarf. Esiriu had already braided up my hair, Dayao style, so that was all right. My father said some more things to the women that made them cower and look away, and then took my hand and hurried me through the rooms and passages. The scarf blew off my head, and he turned back to pick it up and put it over my head so that it hid my face. I could see through it well enough, but certainly did not want it on, and took it off. "Put it on," he said. It was not just order shouting, but nervous anger. He was anxious. "Keep it on, over your face. When you come before my father, salute him." He made the face-knocking movement and made me show him that I could do it. I did all he said. I was frightened by his fear. Terter Gebe was an old man, handsome and thin, with much authority in him. It was easy to behave with respect and courtesy in his presence. He was like the officiant in a great wakwa, full of the strength and dignity of the ceremony. But the officiant gives that back, lets it go, at the end of the wakwa, and Terter Gebe had kept it all to himself for 60 years. All that others gave him, he kept, and he believed, and they believed, that that strength and dignity belonged to him. I did not believe that, but since they were truly there in him, I honored them. I did so as a Condor's daughter, knocking my forehead. I kept the veil over my face until he lifted it and stared at me a while. That I found hard to bear, being looked at full on, shamelessly. He said, "Etiharazra puputiela," which is, "Be welcome, granddaughter." I said in his language, "Thank you, grandfather." He gave me a keen look, very searching. He never smiled. He said something to my father, which I kept in mind till I could ask Esiriu what the syllables meant. They meant, "Better marry this one quickly." My father laughed. He looked relieved and happy now. They talked to each other a while. I stood there like an image of a person, not talking or moving. I tried to keep looking down, the way Hontic women did when they were with Condors, but I wanted to look at my grandfather. Every time I stole a glance, he caught it. At last, carefully and slowly, I pulled the veil back over my face. Through it I could watch him, and he could not tell if I were watching him or not. It is easy to learn to be a slave. The tricks of slavery are like fleas hopping from a dead ground squirrel onto your skin. You have the plague before you know it. And all the tools of slavery have two edges. Since Terter Gebe had accepted me as his granddaughter, the daughters of his house had to treat me as one of them and not as an animal or primitive person. Some of them were ready to be friendly as soon as they had permission to be. Their lives inside the women's rooms were very small and boring, and a new person was a great excitement and interest to them. Others were less well disposed. I wished my father would not order them and bully them as he did. He meant to help and defend me, but every bow and smile and head knock they gave him turned into a sneer or a snub or a trick against me when he was gone to give orders to somebody else, and I was left there in the household. All this was the kind of reversal that it seemed to me one would have to expect in a household arranged like a himpy pen. My father's mother had died many years ago, and his father had not remarried. The widow of my father's brother was the chief of the women of the house. Everything among the Dayao had to have a chief. If two of them were together, one or the other was chief. Everything they did was war. Even when people worked together, one of them was chief of the work, as if working were making war. Even when children played together, one of them told the others what to do, though at least they quarreled about it. So my aunt, Terter Zadyaya Bele, was the general of the women of Terter House, and she was not pleased by my presence there. I thought she was ashamed of me, a hontik, a half-animal, and that was all too familiar to me, who used to be called a half-person, so I hated her. Now I think she was afraid of me. She saw me, foreigner or primitive or animal as I was, the only daughter of the Condor Terter, and feared I would want to take her strength and dignity from her. If we could have worked and talked together and come to know each other, I think it would have been better, for she was not a spiteful person. But that was prevented by our misunderstanding, fixed and made incurable by her jealousy of her power and my shame. In any case, she would not touch me and did not like to approach me because I was purutik, unclean. The mental way, the soul's way of the Dayao, would surely be the most important thing I could tell about them, and some of it I can tell by way of telling my story. But when it comes to their wakwa and rites and all the deepest of their thinking, I learned very little. There were no books. What men were taught, I do not know. Girls and women were taught nothing but the skills of the household. Women were not allowed into the sacred parts of their heimas, which they call daharda. We could come no nearer than the vestibule in front of the daharda to listen to the singing inside on certain great festivals. Women have no part in the intellectual life of the Dayao. They are kept in, but left out. It was not men there, but women, who told me that women have no souls. That being the case, naturally they have little interest in learning about the soul's way. All I learned was picked up here and there, and does not make a whole. This is the best I can make of it. One made everything out of nothing. One is a person, immortal. He is all-powerful. Human men are imitations of him. One is not the universe. He made it and gives it orders. Things are not part of him, nor is he part of them, so you must not praise things, but only one. The one, however, reflects himself in the Condor, so the Condor is to be praised and obeyed. And the true Condors and one warriors, who are all called sons of the Condor or sons of the sun, are reflections of the reflection of one, and therefore also to be praised and obeyed. The Tion are very dim and faint reflections far removed from one, but even so they have enough of his power to be called human beings. No other people are human. The Hontik, that is, women and foreigners and animals, have nothing to do with one at all. They are purutik, unclean, dirt people. They were made by one to obey and serve the sons. This is what they say. It seemed to me to get a little complicated, since Condor's daughters gave orders to Tion and talked about them as if they were dirt people. But that discrepancy is kept out of mind, since the daughters all live in the city and seldom even see the farmers. It must have all been very different when the Dayao were nomads, but it may have started then, too, as a matter of sexual jealousy, the chief men trying to keep their wives and daughters clean, and the women holding themselves apart from the strangers they met along their way, and finally all of them coming to think that to be a person at all is to be separate from and apart from everyone and everything. They say that as there was a time when one made everything, there will be a time when everything will stop being, when one will unmake everything. Then will begin the time outside of time. He will throw away everything except the true Khandars and one warriors who obeyed him in every way and were his slaves. They will become part of one then and be forever. I am sure that there is some sense to be made of this, but I cannot make it. Some of the things I learned in the Lamb Lodge in Sinshan were warrior lodge teachings learned from Khandar soldiers during the years they stayed in the valley. The warrior lodge men thought they were practicing true Khandar ways. In fact, they understood even less than I did. They understood that men were better than women, and that nothing was of any account except one and men. But they got the rest of it and the reasons for it all mixed up. I don't think most of them ever understood that there was indeed only one. Their souls and minds were much too dirty. That part about being Purutic, about dirt persons, made sense to me in its way. In order to reflect, a mirror has to be clean. The cleaner and clearer and purer it is, the better it will reflect. True Khandar warriors were to be one thing only, reflections of one, setting themselves apart from all the rest of existence, washing it from their minds and souls, killing the world, so that they could remain perfectly pure. That is why my father was named Kills. He was to live outside the world, killing it, to show the glory of one. As I speak of it this way sounds clownish. That is myself, my voice. I am the clown, since I cannot help the reversals. The Dayao way was without clowns or clowning, without reversal or turning, straight, single, terrible. The third part of Stone Telling's story begins on side 9.